This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 4th of June 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 34th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bounds. On this show, we get multidisciplinary, and here's how. We'll speak to our favourite theatre critic, Matt Wolfe, of the International Herald Tribune, about what's rocking Broadway in the lead-up to the all-important Tony Awards.
There is always that thing on Broadway that the productions have to be famously extrovert. They have to push. They have to really go after every last audience member who's paid every last penny in his or her bank account. And with this show, you can feel the audience leaning into the show.
And we'll explore how Berlin's impeccably cool clubbing community is facing the future in a world of gentrification and rising rents.
He is terrorizing us in the moment when we go outside. On one hand, I can understand him, but no, actually not. I wouldn't invest 3 million euros to be the neighbour of a techno club.
And we'll have a look around the booth at Roma Contemporary, an art fair in a city that's well known for its history and fine art, but needs to convince on the contemporary front.
Roma, I think, was able to really, in the last few years, get rid of a certain kind of old patina, I would say. And it's really like moving forward in a very interesting way. And I think the image of the city really changed in the sense, and art, it's really a part of it.
We also check in at the Thessaloniki Book Fair to see if books can put any sort of a smile on Greek faces and make a racket in an Israeli bomb shelter that's become a recording studio. Phew! That's here on Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. First of all, you know how it works, a song. This week, Friends have caught our eye and our ears. A new band from Brooklyn with a neat line on lo-fi drum-driven indie soul will play a few tracks from their debut album out this week called Manifest. This song is Sorry. Now, they say the neon lights are bright on Broadway. They say there's magic in the air. One man who knows if this is in fact true is Matt Wolfe, theatre critic for the IHT and a great pal of ours here at The Culture Show. Matt's just back from a Broadway fresh with fervour surrounding upcoming nominations for the Tony Awards. Here's what's hot and what's just warm.
Look, New York loves stars. Mm-hmm. So if you've got a show with a big star, but it has to be a big star who delivers. It can't be like, for instance, Julia Roberts some years ago doing a play called 3 Days of Rain. And everyone thought, well, what does she know about theater? And the answer was actually not very much. So she sold a lot of tickets, but wasn't nominated for anything. It has to be.
And just one evening of drizzle.
Yeah.
In the end.
There's the headline.
Sorry.
You got it. Although it did introduce, actually, that play did introduce a rather interesting young actor who's gone on to great things called Bradley Cooper. So
right.
Sometimes you have to look at the co-stars.
Uh-huh. And is this a thing? I mean, do people watch this? I know that we're going to talk about Death of a Salesman. Maybe we should kick off talking about Death of a Salesman.
Well, Death of a Salesman is actually, of all the shows on now in New York, it answers your question most acutely.
Yeah.
Because it is like the theater equivalent of a prestige entry at the Oscars. Instead of Meryl Streep playing Margaret Thatcher, it's Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Willie Loman. I mean, the archetypal image of a certain kind of American defeat. And here's Philip Seymour Hoffman, who we all know is a great actor. He's already won an Oscar. He's been nominated for Tony Awards before, nominated for Tony again for a role for which he's technically too young. I mean, you know, he's much younger than the actual Willie Loman in the play.
He was,
but it doesn't matter.
In his early 60s. Yeah. Early 60s.
And Philip Seymour is a 40-something.
Yeah. Yeah.
But on the other hand, you know, he's got a certain amount of gravitas, both literally and metaphorically, and he has weight, again, literally and metaphorically, and he pulls it off. It's a very hard-working and, I think, high-achieving performance, and the tickets for it, because, you know, the crazy thing about Broadway is they're giving tickets away for, like, 90% of the shows, and then there are 10% of the shows you can't get in for love or money, and the tickets there go for $400 or more a
wow.
pop.
And on Death of a Salesman, obviously, you know, people have been very excited about it. Again, a major Hollywood star, and a Hollywood star that's not really regarded as a star, but as a very good Hollywood actor. I suppose that's the difference. Is it a sort of timely moment for a Miller revival and all the themes that run through that play? I mean, are there echoes of what was going on? It was premiered in...
Yeah,
the early I mean, 50s or...
I mean, I think the fact of the matter is, and it gets done on Broadway a lot, Brian Dennehy was in a wonderful production of it about a decade or so ago, and before that, Dustin Hoffman, the Brian Dennehy production actually transferred to the West End. But, you know, it's a play about somebody chasing the American dream, which turns out to have gone sour on him. It's very much a play about money or the lack thereof. It's a play about the difficulty keeping it together. And spoiler ahead for people who don't know the play, it has an unhappy ending. So that's very uncharacteristic, of course, of what we think of as the mainstream American theater. This is a play that really rocks audiences, and at the core of it is the relationship between a father and his son, and there's been a lot of attention in this production because the son is played by Andrew Garfield, who's an Anglo-American actor.
Watch out for the co-star.
Who is about to be on screen in Spider-Man.
Right.
So...
I mean, that's a big news. That's an exciting production. That's on Broadway, I'm guessing.
It's absolutely on Broadway.
Very on Broadway.
It is so on Broadway. You can't move it
All right.
until the 2nd of June when it finishes.
Well, let's give that famous, if impossible to navigate, thoroughfare another chance. What else is on Broadway?
Well, the interesting thing is you might well assume Philip Seymour Hoffman playing Lily Loman, there's a Tony Award dead cert if I ever saw one. But actually, the money at the moment on the Best Actor Tony Award is not going to go to Philip Seymour Hoffman, but oddly, and I think rather deliciously, to the English actor James Corden, who about 8 weeks ago was a complete unknown in America. I mean, of course, a lot of the television series and whatnot in Britain that he's done have not transferred to the States. So he just went cold in the British comedy One Man, Two Governors. Of course, huge sellout in London, still running here in London. But in New York, you know, who is this guy? Looks a little bit like a younger Philip Seymour Hoffman, actually. But the funny thing about it is that Broadway is uniquely good at really welcoming newcomers, particularly if they're English. And they've absolutely clasped James Corden to their collective bosoms as many years ago. They did Janet McTeer and Nigel Hawthorne and other actors from this side of the pond. And his performance, Corden's performance, which I'd seen in London and again in New York, is just so winning. He comes on stage with the Music Box Theater on 45th Street, and he gives this enormous grin. And you can feel 900 people just go, we don't really know who you are, but we like you.
That's a relief. I presume that's also it's a relief for an audience as well, especially if you spent, you know, especially if you spent $200 a ticket and you might have to go out for dinner afterwards and et cetera, et cetera. It's a sense of relief, presumably, that an audience can... Do you feel that's collective? Oh, we can relax, this guy can act and he can be funny.
Yeah.
It's a great farce.
And that's exactly right. And they feel like they can let their guard down and that he's sort of guiding them. He's like this wonderful guide through the next 2.25 hours of mayhem. And at times it gets kind of dangerous because, as people know if they know the play, there are individuals from the audience who get called up on stage. New Yorkers famously hate that. They actually really dislike that much more than English do. But I think in this case they go, it's all right, we trust you. You can do what you want with us. And he does some pretty wild and crazy things.
And the idea of this famous farce making it onto Broadway, is that rare? I mean, Broadway doesn't seem a massively funny place to me.
Well, the irony about Broadway is that there are productions where you think this is the gloomiest, dreariest play ever, and then it goes to New York and everyone's laughing maniacally at it, and people go, I didn't know this play was funny. You think, it isn't actually. The audience just doesn't get it.
Yeah.
It's often said of comedy that comedy is the thing that travels least well. I mean, we all cry. Somebody dies, we cry. That's pretty universal. Somebody, you know, falls off a ladder, it may be funny to you and not to me, or vice versa. And farce is very particular. This play draws on a lot of English music hall tradition, panto tradition, vaudeville tradition. But I think the New York audience, again, with James Corden as their fearless leader, is kind of saying, okay, we'll go along with this. Interestingly, there's a supporting actor in the cast, not Oliver Crist, not Jemima Rooper, but a much less well-known actor called Tom Eden, who plays this really vertiginous 87-year-old waiter who has a precarious relationship to life. And he was in it in London, and he got good reviews. In New York, he's had ecstatic reviews, and he's been nominated for Tony up against Andrew Garfield, and I think he might end up with the TV show.
And what else then? We've got, I know you wanted to talk about Once.
Well, the best musical category, which is the one that Once falls into, is always kind of the big money category, because no matter how well a play does, its life is finite. Musicals, of course, can be cloned around the world and can make zillions, as we know from Phantom of the Opera on downward. The best musical category this year is dominated by two shows that could not be more different one from the other. One of them is the latest from the Disney stable, Newsies, which is actually based on a flop Disney film of some years back that starred Christian Bale. Mm-hmm. And it now looks like it's going to be the most successful Broadway show they've had since The Lion King. And the other is Once, which is based on a successful but tiny indie-Irish movie that won an Oscar a couple of years ago for a beautiful song in it called Falling Slowly. And the stage show, directed by an Englishman, John Tiffany, is adapted from this film, and it is absolutely beautiful. It's like an anti-Broadway Broadway musical. There are no chorus lines. There are no fancy sets. There are no sort of, you know, people doing elaborate choreographic routines. It's very, very wistful, poignant, relatively small scale. The cast plays their own music. It's set in an Irish pub. And it just has taken the town by storm, which gives me hope about the future of New York.
It's a heartstring plucker.
It is a heartstring plucker. As instruments on stage are being plucked, so is your heart, really genuinely.
I wonder where on that scale, if you know, it sounds like an indie Irish hit, possibly is tantamount to a Disney miss. Presumably, it probably made the same amount of money.
Yeah, well, yes, probably. Yeah. But it's so interesting because there is always that thing on Broadway that the productions have to be famously extrovert. They have to push. They have to really go after every last audience member who's paid every last penny in his or her bank account. And with this show, you can feel the audience leaning into the show, going towards the show, kind of meeting the show on its terms. Whereas Newsies is like, you know, it's quite winning in a way, but it's a 2.25-hour pep rally with songs called things like, you know, Keep the Faith and lots of, you know, punching the air. And it's kind of variations on that for, you know, a bit.
So moving on from One Man, Two Governors and Death of a Salesman, Once and Newsies, what about the vibe this year? Is there a thread running through any of these things? Is there a theme? Can you read into anything of the choices other than that people are Tony Award hungry?
Well, people are always Tony Award hungry. I think Broadway occasionally likes to think of itself as being brave and daring, even though you could argue whether it is or not. And not just Once, as an example of that. There's a two-hander on Broadway, a play called Venus and Fur, which the male lead is the British actor Hugh Dancy, who's married to Claire Danes, and he and Claire Danes live in New York. And his female co-star, who's the hot favorite to win the Tony for Best Actress, is a young unknown called Nina Arianda, who's in her mid to late 20s. And it's basically a two-hander about S&M. Now, that is not the kind of thing, trust me, that you find on Broadway every single day. And I think the Broadway audience, which is older probably than in London and a bit more matronly and perhaps a bit more small-C conservative, I think they go to this and I think they get off on it because this is like, ooh, this is a bit kinky.
Do you think there's lots of sort of slightly sweaty-handed matinee performances?
I saw it at a Saturday matinee and the sweat was oozing out of every seat.
So sort of 50 Shades of Grey for the Upper East Side. I like that. And it sounds like great fun. It sounds amazing. You're in a privileged position to be going to these things, but then the writing comes afterwards, of course. But what's it like, going to all these things in such a sort of short amount of time and trying to sort of focus, right, tonight is this, tomorrow is that, and dissociating your own sort of excitement for certain performances and for certain plays to having your sort of critical faculties highly tuned at the same time?
It's a very good question and it's a paramount question. It's interesting to me because, you know, I'm from New York originally, though I live in London. A lot of my New York brethren and sisteren like to complain about the fact that, oh my God, you know, we had to go to 5 Broadway shows this week and we saw 4 last week and we can't wait till the season is over and we can relax. And I think, you know what? If you lived in London and went to the London Theatre across the year, you would do that every week. I mean, here I am back in London, and what am I going to mostly now is this extraordinary sequence of plays at Shakespeare's Globe called Globe to Globe, which is every single Shakespeare play, each one done in a different language. And that means that, you know, I'm going to Shakespeare alone 3 times a week. It's actually, if you love the theater, it's like being on a kind of unstoppable roller coaster. But this kind of activity will test your love. If you don't love it, you get off the ride pretty fast.
Well, I think we'll have to check in with you later on in a few weeks and see how the Shakespeare marathon's going at the Globe. But for the time being, with your thoughts on Broadway irritatingly gnawing away at its nails before Tony Awards season, Matt Wolfe, as ever, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
For those of you just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now to Berlin, where the famous club scene spawned the easy jet set generation, people coming over for a weekend or just a night to experience the best of Berlin's nightlife. Now many of Berlin's legendary clubs have had to shut their doors due to rising rents and noise complaints. With more than 15 clubs under threat of closure, local government has recognised how crucial Berlin's club scene is to the local economy, and it now plans to set up a music board with €1 million, some of which will help clubs find new locations. Abby Darcy, Dressed to Kill, and ventured into the Berlin night.
Uh, It was built up in 1929 as a tarmac factory. And during the war, Adolf, he was repairing his panzers in here. You know, it's a lovely location at the River Spree. It's just perfect.
Christian Mill runs Magdalena, a techno club on the banks of Berlin's river. Locations like this are gold dust and prime real estate. A lot of the disused factories and warehouses along the river used to house Berlin's best-loved clubs, and one by one, they're being evicted by property developers. This club has been in limbo for years. New investors tried to shut it down at least three times.
Last weekend, for example, the Saturday party stopped on Monday evening, 10 o'clock. We closed it with a huge open air at the outside area, and yeah, it was amazing. We have a neighbor here. It's a rich lawyer, and he bought the two top stories of a building here and invested millions for his own flat. Since he did that, he tried everything to get us out here. He is terrorizing us in the moment when we go outside. He's calling the police, he's writing letters. On one hand, I can understand him, but no, actually not. I wouldn't invest 3 million euros to be the neighbor of a techno club. It's just mad, in my opinion.
He's trying to take you to court, or?
He's trying.
It's a similar story across the city. Berlin's clubs are typically nomadic. Some say that gives the scene its kick. It's constantly evolving, reinventing itself. But space is now a rare commodity, and local government is finally taking notice. Working with the Club Commission, a network of Berlin's clubs, they're designing a music board, a sort of hotline to politicians, with a small fund for things like legal advice. Lutz Leixenring from the Commission says clubs need more recognition.
The scene has a big impact on other branches, like the fashion, the film, but also specialists for the IT branch. They're also moving to Berlin because Berlin is very in hip. And also a very big part is tourism. I mean, there are about 10,000 young people coming every weekend to club. Some years ago, the politic recognized that, but still didn't change anything. And now I think we are on a point where we can start changing things.
The band Messer are squeezed into Schokoladen. This place is a bit of an anomaly in the chic, gentrified district of Mitte. The rundown former squat is now an art and living space with a theatre and club. The owners have tried to evict Schokoladen since 93. With a lot of graft, they've won themselves a long-term lease. Anja Gerlich lives and works here.
Due to the changes in the area, there's many more people that have moved in that are used to their quiet. And so we do have neighbourhood problems right now. We're now doing early bird concert from 8 to 10. We stop the music at 10, and then after that it's just a normal bar. We think that it's really important to have a variety of things in a certain part of town to offer opportunities for people with less money to, yeah, we don't offer daily needs or necessities, but we offer something else, you know, an open space where the neighborhood can meet, where you don't need to, you know, follow the market rules. It's not only so-called high culture, you know, museums and opera that attract tourists to the city, but the clubs are not in the center anymore, and you don't want to have clubs only at the dark, far-out corners of the city.
A few streets away, down a nondescript alley, past a wheelie bin and some outsized stage props, behind an unmarked door is Cookies, a fixture on the club circuit. It was once a cinema, and the newly revamped club has a 1920s feel. There's a warm smell of popcorn, large golden peacock lamps on the bar, and long black sofas.
This is like a little garden, and at the back there's our wedding chapel. What chapel are you heading?
Cookie is the owner. He opened his first bar in a tiny Berlin cellar in 94, and this is now Cookie's number 7. He was turfed out of 6 locations by landlords or new investors. Good space is hard to come by, but Cookie is wary of the city interfering.
Berlin is growing because the clubs aren't anymore so concentrated in one corner. It's just moving about. is changing really fast, but also in a good way because it's just keeping on moving. I've been always in the past changing things. Like in the last club, after 1 year, I got bored and opened up a small illegal restaurant above the club. That got found out. I had a little bit of trouble. Then I opened up a year later a huge official restaurant in that club. And so I think to make things interesting, to keep things alive, you always have to reinvent yourself and change, because otherwise it gets boring. What makes Berlin special, all these illegal clubs that are hidden or different or perhaps not fully illegal, that they're not allowed to have a dance license or something, but that makes a special thing about Berlin out. But also just having the costs so high, like the tax and the changes, is going to make Berlin a difficult city in the future for club life.
Behind a dark gold curtain is the dance floor, where the DJs are warming up the crowd. On the lineup tonight, Londoner John Osborne, now a resident DJ at the club with two of his own record labels and techno and house running through his veins.
I thought I would stay for a year or so and ended up staying here for 13 years. The major difference between Berlin and London was the fact that in Berlin I could suddenly breathe. I could suddenly see what the problems were for me anyway with London and living in London. The standard of life in Berlin allowed me to think and to be a lot more creative and to give me the time to follow what my passion of what I wanted to do, which was being involved in music, which in London that was nearly impossible due to the high rents and the high cost of living, and I spent 90% of my time working to pay the rent, basically. So it literally was sort of like an epiphany.
And that's the puzzle, how to preserve this unique climate which has bred generations of DJs and artists and established what is still now a largely experimental and non-commercial club culture. How to do that and remain an international clubbing destination. For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Abby Darcy.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, and we're back with a visit to the Thessaloniki Book Fair after this.
Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
For the latest Monocle news, previews on upcoming films, glimpses of the new issue, and the inside scoop of all of our retail ventures and new products, you need to do one simple thing. Subscribe to the free Monocle Bulletin. Sign up now at monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture. Thessaloniki recently hosted the annual International Book Fair that brings together the leading publishing houses from the Mediterranean and the Balkans and independent publishers from the rest of Europe. In the 9th edition of the book fair, the Greek publishing industry is trying to come through a heavy financial crisis, which causes books to get dusty on the shelves, as Sakis Ioannidis reports.
9 years ago, the Greek National Book Centre decided it was time the country's then flourishing publishing industry should come together and discuss their craft and business along with their overseas counterparts. Thessaloniki, a harbour city in northern Greece, was chosen as a natural crossroads through the Balkans and a joint point for the East with the rest of Europe to host the International Book Fair. Almost a decade later, the financial crisis has prevented six of the major Greek publishers from attending the annual meeting, indicating the difficult state they find themselves in. Ahmed Patakis, one of the leading Greek publishing houses, flicking through Greece of debts and bankruptcies. This book is a flashback to the country's financial burdens since the formation of the modern Greek state. I'm here to meet the publisher Anna Patakis and to see if the financial crisis is a bestseller in Greece.
People buy less, more cautiously. They're very, very concerned about the retail price of the book, which wasn't the number one factor when it comes to a book by a very well-known author. Now the retail price is the number one factor. I think that we could say that fiction is more affected than the other field, maybe because also there were a lot of fiction, and maybe because now people also want to learn about the situation. So all these books about the crisis, about economics, about how the crisis has affected different periods of history, they are more popular, and it's an emerging field.
Of course, economic hardships in the publishing industry aren't a uniquely Greek phenomenon. The 400-odd publishing houses in nearby Serbia aren't immune either. It takes 5,000 sales to make a Serbian bestseller, but they wouldn't mind more. Mladen Vesković from the Serbian Ministry of Culture has a head for figures.
One of the basic characteristics, like in many other post-socialistic countries or countries in transition, that means there is a lot of titles, but the print run is relatively low. That means that we had average per year in let's say in 5 or 6, 10 years, around 4,000 titles printed in many areas, but in literature around 400 up to 1,000 per year. But the print run are relatively small, from 500 to 1,000. And if you sell, let's say, 5,000 copies, you can say that you have the best seller in Serbia in one year. According to official statistics, average salary in Serbia around 380 euros. That means that if you have the book which is 5, 6 or 8 euros, it is relatively high price for the citizens of Serbia to buy at least one title per month.
It's Saturday, the third day of the fair, and it's been raining all morning, but it's not deterring hundreds of book lovers visiting Publishers' Kiosk at the Thessaloniki's International Exhibition Centre. There's a buzz around the independent publishing house Arcadia Books from the UK, a frequent visitor of the fair.
I'm Gary Pulsifer, the publisher of Arcadia Books in London. I've probably been to the book fair 4 or 5 times over the years, and it's an opportunity to meet not only with Greek publishers and agents, but colleagues from the Balkans and further afield.
How would you describe the publishing industry in the UK, especially for independent publishing houses like Arcadia Books?
In the UK, the publishing scene is changing dramatically, like everywhere else in the world. It's particularly challenging for independent publishers and booksellers, but for the publishers, sometimes they're better equipped to cope with change in the fact that they specialize in certain kinds of books and know their market. But that said, it's still a very challenging time to do with the high street bookshop chains, the independent bookshop chains, and the importance of Amazon and the internet and how that all comes together.
The wind of change in the book business blows not only through Europe, but affects the rest of the world too. Florence Noaville, a book reviewer from Le Monde, and an author herself, flew to Thessaloniki after spending some time in New York, where she was stunned to see no more than 10 branches of Barnes & Noble.
I'm just back from New York, where I was sent for the newspaper, and I asked a cab there to bring me to Barnes & Noble at the Lincoln Center, and he said, well, there is no Barnes & Noble anymore at the Lincoln Center. And I said, what? And then I discovered that the Barnes & Noble, the bookshops, the very famous bookshops, there are only 7 left in Manhattan. I asked why, and they said it's because everybody buys on Amazon now. And 20% of the market, of the revenue in the publishing industry, is made on Amazon. And this is exactly what we will have to face. And of course, the consequence is, how about the bookshops? As far as France is concerned, up to now the bookshops have survived relatively well thanks to a law which is called Loi Longue and which prohibits the discounts on books. And the big question is, how about this law? Is it going to go on, or will the European institutions want to challenge it because of competition rules?
After 4 days at the fair, it seemed that the publishing industry was shining a little spotlight of optimism on the Greek tragedy. Despite the difficulties, this year's event gathered 200 publishers and created a bit of buzz for the local economy. Next year's event is scheduled for May 2013, but nobody can tell for sure if the books will be sold in euros or drachmas. For Monocle, Thessaloniki, I'm Sakis Ioannidis.
Still to come in part two, we visit an Israeli recording studio fashioned from a distinctly un-rock and roll bomb shelter, visit Italy's Roma Contemporary Art Fair, and hear again from Friend's great new album. And here we are from their new album, Manifest. This is Friend's with A Thing Like This. That was Friends singing A Thing Like This, and you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. Now, the word Israel is more likely to prompt images of gun-toting soldiers than denim-clad rock guitarists, but air sirens now seldom ring in Israel's north, and young people have turned shelters, which once used to protect residents from falling artillery, into jam spaces and recording studios. It's a twist on the iconic American garage band as young Israelis pursue their dreams as musicians. Monocle's Rebecca Collard visits one bomb shelter-turned-studio in Israel's north.
Nadav Dagon makes underground music, in the literal sense. About 10 kilometers southeast of Haifa, in the town of Bet Oren, Nadav records and produces music in a bomb shelter.
So this is the shelter. This way. I was around 14, maybe 15, and I'm a drummer, as I said, and I just made too much noise for my neighbors. I was looking for a place to put my drums, and this place was so dusty and dirty and full of all the garbage of all the neighborhood. Like, everyone put here all the things he doesn't need from home. And I push it all away and I make a little circle for my drums. And it was sitting in the middle of this room full of dust and darkness. And it became like a rehearsal room and all the way to what we have now.
What they have now is a professionally equipped space, walls insulated with mattresses and outfitted with a mixer and synthesizer, that has attracted more young Israelis to come make music underground.
My name is Eyal Schwartzman, and I play the Bootsman. I'm a lead singer. And I live in Bet Oren.
What brought you guys to Bet Oren? Like, why did you come here to play music?
I came to a conclusion that I want to get into music, like, intensely and seriously. It just seems to me that, like, the people here are really doing it, and I want to surround myself with music, and it seemed like a natural choice that if I want to do music, like, this is the place.
The Bootsmen are just finishing the recording and mixing of their second album here inside the shelter. The band's bassist, Boaz Benter, says there are downsides to using this kind of space.
And when we recorded the album of the Bootsmen, because it's a bomb shelter, you don't have air. So the recording was very hot and sweaty, and we're like nervous because there was no air, and every second you open the door between, you know, like the drum takes. So it was not easy.
Bet Oren is not the only Israeli community to reimagine their local bomb shelter as a recording space. In Ayel's kibbutz, the bomb shelter temporarily served as a bar. It was moved to a bigger space, and then the shelter was used to make music.
I started to play music when I was 15, and we used to rehearse also in a bomb shelter.
Why do you think it is that in so many kibbutzes and so many communities that they're doing that?
In Israel, it's not allowed to charge rent for bomb shelters.
In Bet Oren, the shelter studio helped draw musicians from other parts of the country, fostering a creative community.
My name is Nave Shifroni. I play in the Bootsman guitar. And I play guitar and sing in another band called I Was a Bastard. I met Nadav and we talked about music, and they decided also I want to make music. And this is what I want to do with my life. So I just moved here, and then it started like to be more and more people that moved here, and we started to have a lot of groups, musical groups here.
The community suffered a blow last summer when a fire ripped through the Carmel Mountains, destroying much of Bet Oren.
Actually, the place we are in was burned, like all around. The house above was burned, and when you go outside, you see this viewpoint here. It was a neighborhood, and it's destroyed it. We came in through the door, and we tried to smell, and it was like, smell nothing. It was no electricity, so we tried to light with our phones, and we see that everything is the same. We came to the drum, which is, it can crack if it's too hot, because it's leather. So I tried to drum on it, and it was tuned. So it wasn't even, the heat didn't came in here, even.
The musicians say that the work that comes out of the shelter is unique, and that the space allows a freedom that isn't possible in more professional studios in centers like Tel Aviv.
When we rehearse and when we record here, it has like it's a very natural sound of like full sound of guitars and full sound of drums. It's and you can hear it of everything that comes out of here. It's really special.
I feel it's a natural thing can happen here because it's not like a professional studio environment in a way that you look at your watch all the time, and it's like you have this freedom that only a place you treat as home allows you, like to make music, and you can hear it through the music that people feel liberated and they have freedom to do whatever they want.
But as chaos continues in neighboring Syria and tensions rise between Israel and Iran, these underground studios could be under threat. The government believes local residents may need the shelters for protection should bombs fall again in Israel's north. Nadav hopes this threat doesn't materialize.
I want to produce more music here. I want to create albums here. Every time I have a vision, I imagine myself coming here and making it. So for a while, it's the best place to create music for me. Yeah.
While this threat looms, in the shelter, the show goes on. For Monocle, in Bet Oren, I'm Rebecca Collard.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24, and we're off to Rome after this.
Nestled into the urban fabric of London, Hong Kong, New York and Tokyo, Monocle shops are small, cozy outposts of everything we care about. That's incredible design, credible provenance, charming service, and of course, intelligent journalism. Stock up on the latest issue of the magazine, browse our carefully curated selection of books and music, or seek out your favourite back issue to fill that gap in your Monocle archive. So drop in to one of our shops, and our friendly staff will be on hand to show you around. For addresses and opening hours, visit monocle.com.
You're listening to Monocle 24. Join us at 2200 hours London time and end the day with the Monocle Daily, live every weekday.
Welcome back to Culture. Rome is more. This is the latest message you'll read pretty much everywhere walking around the Italian capital. As the city keeps its frenetic tourist activities connected to its massive historical heritage, something else is going on, and it has nothing to do with the good old Romans. Roma Contemporary, a young art fair, hopes to convince those fresco lovers that contemporary art is where it's at. Sarah Schifano went in search of the truth behind the bus at Roma Contemporary.
Sono le gallerie, e tra di loro, prime fra le prime, sono le gallerie romane.
Under a boiling sun in a courtyard of Macro Testaccio, a 19th century former slaughterhouse, it's hard to think this is a contemporary art fair. With its relaxed aperitivo opening times, Roma Contemporary belongs to the newest breed of its kind, the boutique art fair. The outdoor area, filled with leisure lounges, a cutting-edge temporary bookshop, bars and collateral program spaces, also hosts the out-of-range section, a selection of artworks organized by American curator Chris Sharp, in which the visitors can literally bump into the works.
The section that I curated is a kind of long, open corridor on cobblestones, and you enter in the middle of the corridor, so to speak. It's a really wide corridor, let's say. But I like the idea that you would look right and left and basically see the same show. And in the context of an art fair, you know, it took on a kind of... I don't want to necessarily say criticality, you know, but this idea that you're entering this context where you're supposed to be able to buy a unique, precious object, and then all of a sudden you see it doubled in this open space. And aside from that, I really, I like the idea. It's a boutique art fair, so it's small. There aren't that many galleries, and I like the idea of curating my section sort of in the spirit of a boutique art fair. So it's in many respects, it's kind of immaterial. Like this Esther Clay's piece you see right when you walk in, it consists of two metal frames that are empty aside from a bit of colored pigment which is thrown on the ground. So you can almost miss this piece, you know. But and then I think you spend some time in the section and works begin to emerge and clarify themselves.
The atmosphere at Roma Contemporary escapes the traditional image of a supermarket fair, where two-dimensional works are exhibited and ready to fly off the wall. In the past decade, director Paolo Rampini, together with Roberto Casiraghi, has created a number of innovative art fairs in Italy, and is sure that Rome is the place to be right now.
Rome actually thrived on the contemporary art scene 20 years later than many other cities. But with the official opening of the Macro and Maxi, which did work also in the years before the official opening of the building, of the museum as a building, they did work with exhibition and so on. A smaller type of work. But with the official opening of the museums, it started a whole new interest. There is a very interesting art scene with the new galleries are opening, many new private foundations or associations working with contemporary art. And it's a city where it's all developing, and it's very interesting because it starts to develop now. There still are two or three galleries offering modern art. Modern art in Rome does have few important collectors, and for the time being, I think it's good to keep them. I mean, also collectors maybe do evolve, and it takes time to evolve. It did change quite radically because we increased and we insist on working with more younger and emerging galleries. Because in the young and emerging galleries there is the future, I mean there is the energy, there is the new things that are happening, and so that's why we pushed strongly that section.
The challenges of putting together an art fair with the coolest and newest galleries are many, especially given the current economic situation. Luca Cerizza, an Italian Berlin-based curator, was invited to organize the startup section, dedicated to galleries with 5 or less years of activity.
we could see that we've been through, of course, a difficult time in this month. And we could have really realized that at a certain point when the crisis exploded in Italy, that was became more difficult to invite galleries from all around the world because the image of Italy, of course, was not at its peak. Nevertheless, I think with the new section that we invented, which is called Startup Project Space, we were able to invite definitely all the best young galleries in Italy and some interesting positions from Europe, from Bratislava to Berlin, from Geneva to Bulgaria. And we created, I think, an interesting section with different languages and positions, which made, I think, quite enjoyable to see.
The event has a strong social character and is reflective of an evolving lifestyle in Rome.
And Rome, I think, was able to really, in the last few years, get rid of a certain kind of old patina, I would say, and it's really like moving forward in a very interesting way. And I think the image of the city really changed in the sense, and art, it's really a part of it.
Paola Rampini agrees.
It is because the museums are young, because the foundations and associations are young, because the collectors are younger than in many other cities. I mean, they just started to approach contemporary art, and there are a few very interesting young galleries that chose Rome to set their galleries. Yes, Rome, as always in that century, had some moment where young people did develop. That's why it's the oldest and most important city in the world.
That was Sarah Schifano reporting from Roma Contemporary. And you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, on Monocle 24. So that's just about all we have time for this week. We hope you enjoyed Matt Wolf on Broadway, Roma Contemporary, Israelis sheltering from rock and roll rather than bombs, the Thessaloniki Book Fair and the fresh sounds of Friends. This show is produced by Katie Bourbeau and the show is studio managed, seriously, by Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week. This is I'm His Girl from the album Manifest by Friends. Thanks for tuning in. When you see me